Session number 17629, David Ridley, Reel 13.
Mr. Ridley, Reel 13. Before we come to other matters, Mr. Ridley, over a period of time, being in danger over a long period of time, does caution take over? Do you learn from that experience?
Oh, yes. Yes. Everything that you were taught as a recruit becomes into the being. But as I said before, you cannot teach a soldier actual warfare because the danger of being killed is not there. But once he goes in action and the danger of being killed is there, all these things that he was taught at the depot becomes into being. You know, how to dig a trench even, how to go on a patrol, how to fire your weapon at night, because firing a weapon at night, you're inclined to fire high. You were taught, you know, to aim low and all these sort of things. All this comes back.
Was there a reluctance or an increasing reluctance to go forward into danger as time went on and you'd been through so many actions unscathed?
Well, there was a little, but I mean, you had a job to do and it just had to be done. Whether you got your lot or not, it was immaterial. You tried your very best. And there's one thing that I'll mention here. I once got an officer out of the parachute regiment. Now, I didn't know till later on that he'd been hurt in a parachute jump. He'd hurt his spine. Now, whether that affected him or not, I don't know. I don't know what they were like in the parachute regiment. But this fella, he started jumping, this corporal that was this trophier. He was one of the main corporal I had. He was wanting him to stand to attention in the line and this sort of thing. And he got right up this corporal's nose. And he came to me and he says, "I'm going to go back and complain about him to the company commander." I says, "Well, just a minute, I'll get my hat on and I'll come with you." And we went back to saw Major Gray. Now, I told Major Gray, I says, "Look, there's nobody would get me up in the line risking my life if it wasn't for me country, and what my family would think if I deserted or refused or mutinied or things like that." I says, "These things we've got to do, but we're looking to do them in a sense. But we want the best chance that we can of coming out alive." And he says, "When we get someone who is opposing this or a threat to it," which this particular officer was, I says, I'm sorry, I says, "we must come and complain." Now, as I said about census in the army, when you were, say, marching forward, trying to contact the enemy, you might hear a shell whining over your head. Now, if you hear a shell, you know it's miles away. The shell that will fall beside you, you never hear. Now, everybody was on tenterhooks when you were out in the open, because that was the dangerous part. Because the German retreating used to lie in wait, and he used to wait till you got in a nice little position, and then more you don't think. So your senses were very, very, very acute. So therefore, if anybody heard anything, he shouted down, and everybody down, and you know, and into cover. Now this particular officer, I don't know what was wrong, but he must be in terrible state with his nerves, because every shot, every Shelley heard you shouting down, and we were diving into blooming mud and all that. That was unnecessary. He, I don't know, he wasn't battle conscious. I mean, we would have just ignored that, but when somebody shouted, you don't stop to think what he's shouting about. You get down first, then you do your thinking. So anyway, it was sort of irritating the platoon. And unfortunately, we went back, and Major Gray said, I know just what you mean, and he was sent back.
Do you remember his name?
No. I just knew he was out of the parachute. And I knew later on that he'd had an accident. And probably that was the cause of it.
Did you have to deal with any men, particularly in your own platoon, who were frightened, who became too frightened to move?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
How did you deal with that situation?
Well, I used to be the father again. It normally happened in action. And if a man got so badly frightened, well, I'll give you a special instance. We were in an attack, and I mean, both artillery was stunting, and the Germans were stunting us, and we were stunting, and the shells flying all over the bloody place. And it was at night as well. And my platoon had to go through another platoon and to carry on this attack. This is where I was telling you about the donkey was standing there shot, and where this lad Roberts was killed. Well, we had to go through this. And one of me men, who was quite a good chap, he says, I've just seen a German in a slit trench and shot him. Oh, I says, you shouldn't have. I says, didn't Corporal Toffey tell you we were passing through this platoon? Now, whether he killed this man or not, or shot him or not, or wounded him or not, I don't know. But I went to the platoon officer. I says, there's one of my men says he shot one of your fellas beside the haystack there. I says, you better go and see about it. But I just had to carry on. But he was in such a terrible state that I told him, I shouldn't have done it, but I says, well, you probably shot one of your own men. Then I says, well, all right. I says, go back to Company HQ and just stop there for the rest of this. And that's the way I dealt with him. But he came back, he was all right after that. But
was it confirmed that he'd shot the man?
No, I've no idea whether he was shot or what.
Any other instances, again, of men who, through no fault of their own, just the sheer weight of danger?
Yes, I once got a call, as again, out of the artillery. And I would give them jobs to do, you know, in an attack. I'd say, right, you take your section over there, you know, and do that and do that. And he never would. And I give him a right blow and tell him off on it. And this particular time, I was telling you where this Robertson was killed, and before he was killed, when we attacked this particular thing, we got into this farmhouse, and we were on a road, and across the road was another set of farmhouses, and then this canal beyond that. I said, right, bring your section, come with me, and I went round the end of this house, you know, galloping, because in the open you travel like gazelles. I went flying over to this house, you know, to clear it, and I looked around, I'm on my bloody own. This corporal had kept his section. So anyway, there was nobody in, it happened. And I went back and I gave him a right blow and tell enough. And the next time I went back to company, I said, you come with me. I took him back and I said, he's no good to me, sir. And I told him, I said, he's too frightened to do anything. He can't command anything. And he was just sent back. Is it like this officer? See, this officer was endangering the platoon. This corporal was endangering the platoon. So he just, you know, going. Bad about it, just says, well, you're no good. It's like any job. If you're no good in employment, you're told to, you get your marching orders.
Is there a danger that a person who acts in that way could affect a platoon, could affect men around him?
Yes, it does, yes.
So it has to be dealt with quickly?
Yes, it's got to be nipped in the bud, and you've got to do something, you know, get rid of it. because you see, I had a platoon, there were about 20 men, and I rely on most of them. I knew the way they thought. They knew the way I thought. And I never asked them to do anything that I didn't do myself. And this bull about in training about sending scouts out, and you know, and you walking behind, there's a lot of rubbish. The scout was Joe Soap, Davy, in the front. I used to say, if we were planning anything or we were moving, I always used to have to go to company headquarters, you know, to get the orders and that, and we're told on the map, it showed on the map where we had to go on. I used to go back and I say, well, there you are, this is what we're going to do. These houses, we used to letter the houses, you know, M. This is M1 or M2. Just for quickness, for if you wanted to call artillery fire down. And I would tell them all about this. Now I say, right, all, move out at such a time. And that time I used to go and pick them up, and off we used to go. And it was always, 9 out of 10, I used to be leading them.
What communication did you have with you to get back to call down artillery or whatever?
Well, I've got me own thoughts about this. We had things called 38 sets. Very, very poor. If you walk behind a house, that was it. If somebody walked in front of the set, you had it. And then you had the poor bloke that had to carry. He had a great big battery to carry. He had a 15-foot aerial on some of them. It was always getting wrapped around places. It was hopeless. And yet, shortly after the war, I walked into the police station. I was looking for my son, actually. He took my car and gone somewhere, and he'd been out all night. And it was about 6 o'clock in the morning I went in. And I said to this sergeant, well, you know, was there any patrols that reported accidents or anything? And he says, just a minute. And he picked up a radio set no bigger than, well, a little bit bigger than a pack of cigarettes. He says, I haven't told anybody in County Durham with this. Now, you can't tell me that those things weren't in existence when the war was on. I wouldn't believe anybody. And now, you see, the communications now. You can talk to anybody in the world by a phone.
So if your radio failed, how did you get a message back?
Runner. You had someone I nominated as a runner. Or somebody might want, or say somebody's, the soles of his boots had come off, you know. And the quickest way was to send him back. I say, well, write the message out. Go back to company headquarters and give that to Major Gray. And while you're there, get your blooming boots seen. Or if a weapon had broke down. You say, right, you take that weapon back, and that was the quickest way of doing it.
Could it be a dangerous job, running?
Oh, yes. You see, as I said before, when I was with the Sherwood Foresters, this officer used to run about with his forage cap on. And I was there with my forage cap on. Well, that was very, very dangerous, because you had everybody in steel helmets, and a German OP or a German sergeant said, well, he's obvious the leader, him. See? The same with a single man running through the blooming vineyards, a sniper, because you had snipers behind you, you know, as well as front. They said, he's going to, you know, deliver a message or something like that, and bang. I know we used to wear our tapes and all that, but it was all wrong. You shouldn't. You should have. And in fact, I remember this platoon had got attacked and withdrew through me, and I had to, you know, go for an attack again. And when we drove the Germans off, there was two or three wounded, and Germans as well, not wounded, dead. And Germans on ours. And one was an officer. And what the Germans had done before, they cut his epaulets off, put his pips on. So all these things, what if there's ever another war, to be taken into consideration. It must be all one, because enemy troops do pick out people that are leaders.
Did you have experience of anyone who suffers from shell shock, or battle fatigue, as it's called now?
Not in my platoon, or not in my battalion, as far as I learned. But the time that I went back, when I was with the Sherwood Foresters, when I caught this thing, I went back to this hospital. And the hospital was in an Italian barracks. Well, the Italian barracks was so shaped like a three-sided square. And you had British troops were wounded on the long corridors, as we might say. And the connecting one was the short one. I think myself must have been the officers and sergeant's quarters. That, I remember I was helping his son to take some, there was an ambulance ship in the harbour, and we were putting down names of people that had to go on the ship and go home. And out of this one of these rooms was about 10 people came out, all in single file, and looking at them were as far gone as the coast. And I says, what the devil's this sort? He says, they're all shell-shocked. And he just got the leader and turned them around like that and pushed them in and on, all just followed them back in there. Another thing that happened with me there in that hospital is I was helping his son. I was taking, you know, he said, he has to be carried. He's walking. You know, and I took the names and whether walking or what. And out of Comey Eye, this chap came and he was talking at the side and he says, is there any English troops going home tomorrow? Because this was a Canadian hospital that I was in, actually. I says, I never looked around. I says, I couldn't tell you, not offhand. So after I finished writing, I turned around and he was an old classmate, a chap called Bell. I says, God, great. I says, what the hell are you doing? He said, I'm hoping to go home tomorrow on that. Well, he said, I'm hoping to go on back on that hospital ship. I said, you blooming lucky. I said, I've just come out. So the world is a very small place. Very small place.
Can we look, before we go further with your experiences, can we look at dealing with wounded people? How would you deal with, say, a man in your platoon who was hit? What was the initial first aid, if you want to deal with a wounded person?
Well, we all carried field dressings. In fact, we used to carry them. We had a net on our helmets. We used to stick them in there to break up the iron line. We used to carry a lot there. And the first thing you had to do was, then, I know different now, but the first thing there was to stop bleeding. If he was shot by, you know, a bullet or a lump or something, you had to get a bandage on there and stop the bleed. And then keep them warm and try and get rid of them. See, because it is a fact, this, that you don't kill enemy. You wound them. Probably wound them severely enough so that they don't come back in action, but you wound them because they are more trouble to their own people than anything else. If you shoot somebody, that's all. They just dig a hole and put them in. That's it. That's the finish. Well, if you shoot somebody, they've got to look after them. I know there's a tremendous lot of people involved in wounded people. Now, I spent, when I was in the ordnance fight, I spent about 20, 30 years as a first aider. And I got to know how to treat people with wounds and all that, which is another story. But at that particular time, it was stop the bleeding and get the stretcher bearers forward, get them on there and get rid of them as quick as you possibly could.
You had nothing like some kind of drug that you could give them if
they were pain. Yes, we had. We were all issued with morphia. Well, the sergeants were, but I never had to use any.
Were you trained? Did they give you some kind of rudimentary training for this, or did you just get on?
No, you read the instructions and said, stick the needle in and press. no instructions regarding that.
So after the initial first aid, wherever it might be, the next thing would be, to, as you say, to get help. Now, where would that come from?
Company headquarters. See, in company headquarters, you always had about five people at stretcher bearers. You had signalers. You had, well, not very often, you had the MT with you, but because they were back in air echelon, we call it. But in a company command, you had a jeep, and you had people trained as medical orderlies who came forward and carry your wounded back. Sometimes they used a jeep. Sometimes they just had to carry them. Of course, if they had to carry them, they were assisted by, you know, they say, right, you four men help to carry him back. Don't forget to come back.
Do you have a high regard for your stretcher bearers? They would have to come forward under fire.
Oh, they're very good, yes. Well, that time I was telling you where I got my medal, I sent back for the stretcher bearers and they came forward in no time. And I mean, there was shot and shell flying all over the blooming place. It was a hectic night that. But they still come forward and they took them back.
In the winter that we were talking about earlier, were you issued with, in snow conditions, were you issued with the white clothing at all?
Well, old Quartermaster Major Flanagan did attempt this. Where he got the white sheets from, I don't know, but he made them up into smocks that you put over your uniform. They weren't very successful, though. No, most of the time you did your patrols in your normal equipment. Mine, you used to strip yourself down. You didn't go on a patrol in full battle order, not unless you were going to do a patrol to come and attack after that. But you used to leave most of your equipment behind. You went as light as you could. You carried ammunition and maps and binoculars and things like that that was going to be useful on a patrol. Of course, if it was a fighting patrol, you took everything that you could fight with. Not that I ever went on a one. I remember that Bartella Tower I was telling you about before, this Corporal Toffey and I had to go forward this particular time to get to know patrol routes. And this particular sergeant, that was platoon headquarters in this Bartella Tower, this particular Indian sergeant, him and I got on very, very well. I think he came from the Marathas, they call them, but he could speak quite good English. And every time I said, you come on a fighting for role with me, Johnny, I said, no, you're blooming Nelly. But I used to meet, you know, when we were out of the line, you used to probably amalgamate for some lecture by somebody. And then sure enough, he was there. And he always recognised me. In fact, I'm only sorry I didn't, you know, get to know his name and all that. And
were there, out of your own platoon or company, were there men who you would call good patrollers as against other men who weren't?
Oh, yes. Well, you had the good and the bad and all that.
You have a choice then if you went on patrol? Did you choose who you were going to take?
Well, you did, but you had to give every... I mean, you couldn't go and pick on the same one every time. You had to, you know... In fact, the platoon knew that. But you would sort the good and the bad and take them all, you know, so many good ones, so many mediocre ones. In fact, I would like to bring this point up. I had a chap called King. He was a Cockney. And he was actually, he was like a platoon commander, a section commander, a corporal. But he would never take any promotion. And I so much relied on this man. I used to say, you, King, you take those five men. Well, he was looking after these patrols. Take that section across there and do so and so. And I could always rely on him. Taking it in due, he must have been killed 1,000 times. You know, near misses and all this. In fact, the thing that I want to bring up here, after the war, We were in a place called Gorizia. We were in a hospital. At least a hospital that was being built. It had no wings or anything, and just a framework. And we were about four or five floors up. And we got the orders, we had to move. We had to carry all the company equipment down and load it on the wagons. And while we're doing this, this king started vomiting blood. Now, I don't know what that is. It'd probably be TV, I'm not sure. Anyway, he whipped into the ambulance and off the hospital. Now, in the meantime, we had to move. So we were taken down to the local railway station, put on trucks and sent away. We went to a spa place right in the centre of the north of Italy. Offhand, I can't remember the name. But anyway, after a period of time, we got to know this king had died. Well, we were miles away from where from Gorizia. So I didn't know what to do. And not just my platoon or my company, the whole battalion knew King. It was very well liked. So I said, well, we don't know where he's buried. We can't put a headstone or anything like that. We don't know what's happened to him, where he went to. I says, I know he has, his mother's a widow. Excuse me. I says, how about having a contribution and sending the money to his mother? I said, that's a jolly good idea. So I went round the battalion and I collected, I don't know how much now, but a considerable amount. And I went to the PRI and I says, could you accept this cash for a check? And I told him what I wanted to do. He says, yes, I can do that. And I wrote to this Mrs. King, and I sent her this daughter a letter telling her what had happened to our son. Roy was his name. And she lived in 82 Commonwealth Road, Chatham, Valley, Surrey. And she wrote me this letter back, and I've still got it today. The War Museum can have these letters if they want them. She had three sons, and they were all taken from her through being killed in war. Major Gray, she said on the bottom of her letter, P.S., Major Gray had wrote and told her what had happened to Roy. So that was a private soldier who should have been an officer, really. He was officer material, if only he'd been had that attitude.
What was the overall health of the battalion and your own platoon during the course of the campaign?
It was very good, really. In fact, our medical officer, who I can't remember his name now, but him and I were pals. And him and, I'll tell you another story about it, him and the doctor always used to, he was the doctor, man. Him and the padre always used to talk about it together. And I mean, our padre used to drink like a fish, but he was a gentleman. He was a holy joe when it was needed. And I'll tell you a funny thing that happened in this area where we were talking about it, just out in the Po Valley. We had pulled out for a rest and it was a rainy season. And all we remember, all sergeants and officers was issued with Welton boots and white jackets. And these all these platoon officers come wandering into the sergeant's billet this day. And they're, ooh, look at your miserable faces and all this. And we said, it's all right for you. You've got somewhere to go. I says, Down in Foley, there's a men's canteen. There's an officer's mess, but there's nothing for sergeants. Well, this young officer said, and I have a British photograph in there, he said, well, why not come with us? I said, how the devil can we go to the officer's mess? He said, I'll fix this. So there was three of us. There was this Tudor Davis, and there was this sergeant major who had just joined us. He came from a machine gun regiment.
I forget the name of it.
But it used to be a machine gun regiment. It had Vickers machine gun. We went over their bullets and we all got a blouse. We all got an officer's jacket with pip. I was a lieutenant. My mate was a lieutenant. And this son here was a major. We got on a truck and down the Foley we went. So this officer says, oh, just a minute. I'll go in here and make sure there's no big, you know, like a CEO or somebody in. So we went in. He said, oh, we're all right. So we went in. We had a meal. And they used to drink stupidly at times. You go and order the drinks. And this officer, he put a bottle of wine on the table. I said, what the devil is the bottle of wine for? He said, well, when we've drunk our drinks, while the waiter's going for more drinks, he says, this bottle, we use the bottle in between, sort of.